I'm Fred Wilkinson, Chief Editor of the National Provisioner. Today I'm speaking with David Buckley. He's Principal Scientist with Diversey's Global Research and Development and team. And today we're going to be speaking about bird flu. David, thank you for joining me today. To get things started, can you give us kind of a background on bird flu and how it's become to be such a big concern within the meat and poultry industries?
So I think the bird flu is definitely on the rise, and it's kind of why we're here to talk about it today. And I think it might be helpful for some of the listeners to sort of go over kind of a basic virology, so that they fully appreciate, you know, what is highly pathogenic H5N1 bird flu and why it's important both agriculturally speaking and from a public health standpoint. Does that sound good?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess I'll start off by saying, you know, the flu is kind of a household name. Everyone knows what the flu is. They probably had it at some time in their life. And in virology, we like to classify these into A, B, C, and D. Importantly, we think of A and B the most because they have the most profound impact on human health and animal disease. And really, H5N1, which we're going to talk about today, is really a subtype of A. And, you know, it's important to note that we call it avian influenza because it infects birds. We are starting to see in the popular media that it can infect animals and mammals as well. But there's this species barrier. And put simply, it means that, you know, not every virus can infect and cause disease in every living organism, right? There's a high barrier, or low barrier, depending on the virus and the host that it's trying to infect. So we have to kind of keep that in mind that, you know, when a virus does gain a function and is able to cause disease in a new species, that often leads to a novel pathogen with far-reaching implications. And when we think about influenza, you typically hear this H and N. That's a really common way we categorize these influenza A viruses based on two different proteins. One of the hemagglutinin, we call it H, and then neuraminidase N. And that's where we get this H5N1 from. And when you hear the number H5 or H7 or H9, those are commonly referred to as avian because as we know it today, they don't really, we don't really have immunity for them as humans. And then, you know, a fun fact maybe for the listeners is when you think of Tamiflu, for instance, the common antiviral drug for influenza, that works by inhibiting that N, the neuraminidase activity, so that the influenza viruses can't butt off of your cells and go infect nearby cells. And it's important to also note that, like, when you think of the influenza virus, the actual genetic material is separated into 8 segments. And so some species, like swine, for instance, are able to be infected by both avian and mammalian type influenzas. And so when these two, or when an organism like a swine is infected with both, you get this reassortment opportunity where, like, you have 8 segments from the avian, you get 8 segments from the influenza, from a mammal, for instance. And those might intermingle at what we call reassortment or gene swapping. And that's when you can get these novel pathogens, like the H1N1 swine flu that we got back in 2010, 2011. And so I think that's kind of a basic description and some common things that I'll talk about throughout this presentation, just so everyone has a basic understanding of virology and what this H is and this N is and what gene swapping is and why that's important for understanding human health and also animal health. Any questions on that, Fred?
No, I think that's very, very good background. Appreciate that. Given the threat that the novel disease like avian flu presents food producers, what steps or what considerations should meat and poultry processors will be thinking about and then also be implementing to keep ensure not only a safe quality food is produced, but also to make sure that their workers stay safe as well?
Well, so I guess I'll start off by saying, you know, the bird flu is the bird flu. As we know it today, it doesn't transmit efficiently in humans. So that's good for human health, but we do know that it is highly pathogenic in poultry, which is a concern. But you know, when we think about basic food safety practices, fortunately, highly pathogenic H5N1 is very susceptible to cooking, right? So the meat and poultry that are products that are sold on the market to for not just, you know, human consumption, but other animal consumption. We don't really see significant food safety concerns here. The heat readily destroys the pathogen when you're cooking, you know, meat or poultry or pork, for instance. And then one thing that the FDA did was they went out and tested the retail milk supply and found, you know, no viable H5N1 in the milk supply. And then they as well as the USDA, did a joint study and actually set up a pilot plant and tested the commercial pasteurization methods for milk and found that normal commercial milking pasteurization processes are highly effective at reducing the viable counts of H5N1 in the milk. So that milk's really, really not a concern. I will say as a caveat, raw milk is something that is consumed in the United States. But I would say that raw milk does cause, there's a cause for concern, not just for regular pathogens that occur within that commodity, but you can find H5N1 in milk. And there's been recent studies that have demonstrated that milk can transmit highly pathogenic H5N1 to other animals. So that's why I think raw milk is a high concern, and probably something that you should avoid if you're looking to stay safe and not get sick from milk. But if you think of the flip side too, from an environmental standpoint, influenzas are really not environmentally resilient. They are really weak in the environment. They don't last very long. They don't survive long outside of the host cell. And there's a variety of disinfectants out there on the market that do a really good job at disinfecting against the virus. And EPA has a list out there. I'm sure you probably remember, I think it's list N for COVID, but there's another list out there for H5N1. I think that's list M as in Mike. And so yeah, the environmental surfaces, you know, can be concerning, but we have a lot of great methods out there and technologies to deliver safe and efficient disinfection. But, you know, I think to the heart of your question for workers and what can processors do for the workers, I think number one is PPE, gloves, high quality masks, eye protection. That's really key. Some of those who've been infected, humans who've been infected from livestock like cattle or poultry, they get pink eye or conjunctivitis. You know, this isn't really surprising because the avian influenza does prefer cells with a specific like receptor binding domain, and they try to cleave this what we call alpha-2-3 linkage. You have it in your eye, but you don't. Humans do not have it in the respiratory tract. So I think that's key for the eyeglasses, and why I'm really recommending that. But also, we know the masks are also going to be really good at protecting against inhalation issues, and then gloves, you know, have a multitude of benefits as well. And then clothing management, something I think probably a lot of people don't initially think of, but you get a lot of stuff on your clothes too. And taking that in and out of facilities is really not a smart choice. So having good clothing management as well is important. And then hand hygiene and surface hygiene. So we talked about disinfection before, but also hand washing and frequent hand washing. So having soap, water available is critical. And then manage the risk too. I think, you know, we have workers who cannot get away from exposure to animals. It's just part of the job. But think about limiting that exposure, trying to be more efficient with your time so that you don't spend as much time with the animals. When you think about highly pathogenic avian influenza virus or really any respiratory-based pathogen, the more time spent with someone who is infected or an animal that's infected, the higher the risk is of actually contracting that virus. And then I would say for you know, those specifically who participate in ag fairs or even those facilities that have an agricultural tourism component to it to supplement income, you know, keep animals there for shorter periods of time. I think you can improve signage for guests about not eating and drinking while near the animals. Avoid contact with the animals if that's possible. Although I know for petting zoos, that's a little, troublesome because that's kind of the point of being there. But yeah, again, hand washing stations, hand sanitizer, things like that to improve the overall outcome. And then clean and infect the tracks and feeders and waters and equipment before and after the shows, especially if you're going to transport that equipment back somewhere else. And then I think it is still really important for the worker side to highlight that, you know, H5N1 is only highly pathogenic in birds, right? That highly pathogenic is kind of a scary word, but it's not highly pathogenic in humans. And I think it's important to note too for the workers that there are vaccines out there. So the U.S. has a strategic stockpile of 3 different licensed vaccines that target. They're different clades of the H5N1 virus, but there was an actual recent Nature study that came out. I want to say it's like within the last month or two. They actually took 2 of those licensed vaccines that the U.S. has stockpiled to determine whether or not they generate what we call neutralizing antibodies against this virus clade that we're experiencing in the United States and poultry and bovine. And good news is the 68 volunteers who participated in this did generate neutralizing antibodies against that virus that we're dealing with. That doesn't mean that we're all, everything's well and good. There might be some other correlates of protection we're missing, but it's still good news to know. And I think Fred, you also asked about the processors. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I think so that's the worker side. I think for the processor side, you know, this goes back to the basics, facility layout and design, you know, the core to one of your biosecurity features. You know, I think keep things separate. So clean is clean, dirty is dirty, dedicated exits and entry points, airflow management, removing standing water. We know that avian influenza, the natural reservoir for this is waterfowls or, you know, water-dwelling birds. And so managing the ponds and basins around your facility, I think, is really key. And then reducing food sources for that wildlife that can be in and around your facility, both, you know, on the farm and in the processing facilities as well. And then I think continue to invest in disease monitoring and surveillance. You know, the USDA, I think they came out with this maybe in May, is covering fees for sampling and collecting for testing of the H5N1 and the shipping costs to their health network. And while I understand it's not possible for every group, consider ways again to reduce potential contact with other wildlife, such as birds. It's kind of hard on an open farm, but there are some facilities where you can limit that contact. And then, you know, consider financial aid assistance from USDA. This is particularly for those who are producing milk and who've experienced issues with their herd. And then the other thing too, I think, back to biosecurity is if you haven't done so already, maybe looked at implementing the biosecurity plan that's in line with the Secure Milk Supply program. And then APHIS as well, that's a component of the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA. On May 14th, they highlighted and recommended that there are, you know, key things you should be doing with your herd. And those key areas are minimizing the movement of your cattle, animals who are coming on or off the farms should be isolated for 30 days. And then, you know, conduct pre-movement testing for the non-lactating cattle as well. Those who are lactating, right, they want them to be tested, but, you know, consider that as well for the non-lactating cow, because ultimately the difference between a lactating and non-lactating cow from a susceptibility difference is not really, there's no real difference. So they can get infected as well. So I think those are the kind of the key things I would recommend for processors when trying to control H5N1. For their facilities.
Oh yeah, I just said that it sounds like that for both food producers and consumers alike, that making sure they follow food safety and hygiene best practices is kind of their best defense against mitigating exposure and risk from avian flu.
Absolutely. I mean, the bread and butter of biosecurity for the facilities is sort of what they need to be doing to protect their flocks and their herds from further infection. And then for the consumers as well, basic food safety practices, both at the restaurant level, the retail level, and the consumer level, right? The, you know, inactivating an influenza virus on food or milk or on surfaces is extremely easy because the viruses are not resilient. And you know, food safety, as we know it too, is not really foodborne pathogens per se, but the foodborne viruses that we deal with, like human noroviruses or hepatitis A, those are extremely resilient. And so I want to make sure we make that distinction that, you know, influenza versus norovirus or hepatitis A, that they're completely different arenas when it comes to cooking, disinfection, and some of these bread and butter prevention and control strategies.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.